Any views expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and not of their employer.
Hi, and welcome to the Appen Appen podcast. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
We are all back again in the room.
Well, we say all back again. People may have noticed that Stu's not with us. So, Stu, unfortunately, has had a couple of things going on in his life outside of Admin Admin podcast and has said that he wants to take a step back out of it for the time being and that we're not really sure whether we're going to see him back on this at all at the moment. So we're going to give him some space to do what he needs to do. And if he decides to come back and join us, then great. If he doesn't, you're just going to have to put up with the three of us sort of speaking down your ear holes in the future.
There's only the three of us waffling now.
Yeah, so maybe we'll get this done quicker. Who knows?
Yes. We have got time limit, though, with John's battery left on his laptop.
Yeah. Sorry about that, everyone.
That's good. Okay. Yeah. So, how is everyone doing?
Oh, we're doing all right. I hope everyone enjoyed my little solo venture last week, or last time, rather.
It was almost too good, I thought.
Yeah. So, have you done much more DMP MCP servers than John since last week?
I've done a little bit. So I have Grafana MCP server, which I've been using. I think I've mentioned this on the last one, which I've been using to help me with incidents. But we use Slack for some contexts outside of this call. And I use Claude. And Claude has a built-in adapter to add the Slack MCP to Claude now. So that's quite interesting because you get to also, on top of being able to say, you know, Grafana, tell me about things that you've seen in my network. You also get to say things like, Slack, tell me about when people were moaning about this. And it can correlate the two for incident reports, which is quite good. So I've been doing that. One of the big problems with MCPs is that it's very hard to get visibility into what's going to the MCPs. So I've been playing with the idea, and it's just an idea at the moment, so don't anyone get their hopes up. This is going to be a public project anytime soon. But I've been playing with the idea of writing a proxy for MCPs, so you can see all the requests that have gone into your MCP and all the responses that have come back from them. So that's going to be interesting. Don't know whether that'll fly, whether my company says, you know, you're not allowed to share that with anyone or what, but we'll see what happens. And the last thing I've been doing, again, similar vein, is one of the things that I've found with MCPs is that when you ask your LLM to go and ask your MCP for something, the MCP will return with, on the whole, fairly structured, standardized data that it comes back with. But whether your LLM provides that back to you as a sort of standardized model every time is sometimes a bit tricky. So, and again, this is an internal thing at work, but we'll see whether or not the company decides to do anything with it or not. I've actually asked Claude to write me a command line MCP agent, MCP client. So you can, once you've got your LLM to tell you what it is you need to be asking your MCP, you can then run the same thing through the MCP CLI script. So again, we'll see what happens with that. If it'd be good to get something out of that, but I don't know. But yeah, it's really interesting kind of playing around the edges of what makes an MCP an MCP rather than it just being a data source for your LLM to go and ask questions of via an API system. So. It's interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, John, have you looked at spec-driven development with LLMs and stuff?
Not at all. And in fact, I think it's fair to say that I've never really heard about anything about it. So what have you heard about it?
So, yeah, our company's been looking at, because mine is, I'm a software, well, company I work for, is a Microsoft house. GitHub have got their own. It's called SpecKit. So it's quite interesting. Because you obviously heard of people like going vibe coding where you tell it, right, tell me this. Oh, it doesn't work. Right. Do it again. Why is this not working? Can you? The other one goes, oh, yeah, I'll fix that for you. Whatever. But this is kind of putting it more in an automation way. So it all starts by you set your standards of how you develop your software. So you said, like, if it's .NET or Java or whatever, and you can then say, this is my standards, the way we kind of write our software. This is what we need to make sure that our software follows these guidelines and this. And this is all done in, like, you do it in a markdown file. And then what you do is you start off by, you just tell it that I want to add this functionality to my software. And you then, like you do like a normal user story if you're doing software development, and you write that as a specification. And then you can get, and the good thing is you can get the LLM to help you rewrite that so that it's more understandable for the LLM to understand it. So once you write your spec, we've got it all working as a pipeline so that it goes off through, and that goes off to the engineer manager. This is what you're actually looking for, and then you can agree it, you can redefine it. Once you've redefined it, the first thing you do is, as you were saying, you were talking about last week, John, about test-driven development. So that goes off and writes your tests for you first, and it can go off and write it. And obviously, if it has questions, it can come back to the prompt and say, "Look, can I? Is this what you're expecting for it?" And once you've done all this, you can get it to then start writing the software for you. So. And because it's all doing in very small parts of the development, by ticking it off, it won't move on to the next section until it's kind of ticked it off, if that makes sense. So I've only seen a demo of it last week at work, but yeah, it looks like a better way of doing it than getting better sense of using it as code vibing.
One of the bigger problems, sort of the vibe coding thing, gives you is that so I was listening to a really interesting podcast in the Risky Business News network of podcasts last week, I think it was, where the CEO of Trail of Bits, who are a security company, was talking about how they've kind of rewritten a lot of their processes to be a lot more AI friendly. So effectively, everything is, you know, about writing tests and, you know, pre-commit hooks and things like that. And he said that the biggest thing their humans are doing at the moment is going around and adding tests to all the piece of code they've shipped at the moment. So, but yeah, it sounds like a lot of the kind of movement of the of the LLM kind of world, particularly around coding and you know, those sorts of things, is typically at the moment about going away and writing your code in such a way that, you know, it's using tests almost as kind of like the starting point, which is where a lot of us should have been really coding from in the first place. But I don't know about anyone else, but I kind of came into this just kind of hacking around with PHP and basic various forms on manky old computers, and testing stuff always seemed a bit like hard work when we were getting started with this.
I hadn't really made it to proper languages before LLMs, so I was still on Bash and things like Terraform and so on.
But no, it sounds interesting, and again, it all sounds really kind of sensible to kind of do that sort of thing. So, but yeah, you said it's a particular project. Did you say it was from Google? I think it was. You said
so. There's a couple of people. I think Claude's got their own version. I don't know what it's called, but the GitHub version is called SpecKit. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks for it.
Less on the sort of IT and software side, and more on the business side of things. So I've been working for a while as a contractor, and that generally means you do a contract for a few months, maybe a year, and then you find another contract, move on to the next one, and go on like that. A few years ago, the contract market took a bit of a nosedive, so I ended up doing a, you know, air quotes, permanent job, which wasn't that permanent. But these days, I'm thinking the contract market might do that again. So having a UK limited company, just a way of getting paid, basically, my plan now is to turn that into the word that's used is consultancy. But what that really means is having multiple clients and working for multiple clients at the same time, effectively. So doing a few days here, a few days there, maybe for clients, and just filling up your time that way. But then what about when multiple clients need you at the same time? That means you've got to, you know, you need more people to do the work. So then it comes into sort of building a business and having a company to serve those clients and make sure they're all happy. For me, I reckon there's a bit of a gap in the market for people or for companies that don't want someone for five or can't afford someone for 5 days a week. So, you know, they might want someone for a few days a month or a few days a week. So that's kind of what I'm heading towards, I think, or I'm trying to anyway, trying to break into it. Never done it before. Haven't really got any, well, I've got a plan for how to do it, but yeah, it's something that I'm going to be trying in the next few months. I did want to put it out there as on this somewhat public platform that I'm available for work. So if you are a small company and you need someone for less than 5 days a week or a few days a month, feel free to get in touch.
Just sort of rolling it back a little bit. So you've kind of done the three out of the sort of the main set kind of ways of being employed, you know, working in this industry now. So you've done permanent, in quotes, roles. You've done contracting and you're now doing consulting. That's the three pieces. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah. Well, trying to do consulting. Doing it somewhat at the moment. Yeah.
Obviously, you've not done a lot of the consulting side of things yet. But how have you found kind of the difference between a, and again, in air quotes, permanent job and a, you know, a contracting role? How does that kind of work out for you?
Well, in practice, not that much different day to day. If you're working a contract 5 days a week, 9 to 5, it's much like being in a permanent role, apart from you're not an employee of the company. So you don't get any of the perks of, you know, you don't get a paid holiday for a start. You work out your tax or your accountant does, rather than the company's accountant. And but you know, it also has its advantages in that you have more freedom. You're not an employee, so you're not bound by, you have to be professional, but you're not bound by terms and conditions of the company. It's just terms and conditions of your contract. As a freelancer, as in someone working for an organization without a contract, or maybe without a contract, then it's different again. You know, you're basically working through trusts at that point. So the way that I see this consultancy going anyway is kind of somewhere in between contracting and freelancing, if you like. And, you know, and also it's going to mean a certain amount of kind of project management skills for, and, you know, organizational skills for, and marketing and things like that. So going out there, finding the work, booking the work in, making sure that the work is doable, you know, that, you know, the requirements of the client are quite clearly specced out, and making sure you can meet those and estimating time for those and things like that. So there's a whole lot of stuff that I'm going to be doing and going to be learning during this process, which is quite exciting, really. Just hope it works out. If not, maybe I'll be going to back to those permanent roles.
Well, I mean, I certainly hope it works out. You know, it's I've always valued, and again, everyone kind of is on their own journey and, you know, where their career goes and things like that. But, you know, I've personally always been petrified of taking risks, and the idea of not having kind of that stable, where's the next role coming from, has always petrified the life out of me. So I don't think I've ever worked in a job where I haven't had a contract, you know, and it's always been, I mean, even from the first job I had when I left university, it was like, even then it was like, you've got a period of notice and things like that, which you don't have with, from what I understand, but you don't have anything like that with consulting or contracting. So it's just,
you do with contracting, you generally have a notice period, so it's similar in that way to being employed permanently. I think it's just a case of building up relationships with clients and, you know, having that understanding and having enough prior notice if the work isn't going to be there.
Probably my closest that I've come to the consulting side of things that you're talking about, though, is prior to working for an IT company that was constant support piece, I was doing on-site tech support. And I guess from that perspective, you know, it wasn't me that was doing the the engagement work or the marketing and stuff like that, but it's very similar kind of, you get up in the morning and you've got a schedule of jobs to do, so you're going to go to this place and do 3 hours there, and oh no, it's overrun, what are you going to do? Okay, well, can you bump the next one and let them know I'm going to be there half an hour late or whatever?
Yeah, sounds similar to that. I mean, talking about the risk, as you say, or the you know, being worried about the work, at time of record I've got 2 weeks left of working for this client, and I don't know what's happening after that, so got to try and find something. It might be another contract, to be honest, but yeah, we'll see how it goes.
How would you go about finding the next contract, though? Is it like looking on LinkedIn or?
Yeah, well, LinkedIn is can be good for that. In fact, this client that I'm working for, I put something on LinkedIn just saying I was available, and they said, okay, I'll give it a go, and got some work from them, and then got some follow-on work, which I'm doing now. I've got a website in the works, and we'll put that in the future, in some future show notes probably, but that's just to get back to the technical side, that's been done in Hugo and with the help of an LLM, so the URL will be out there soon.
Talking of LLMs, I've just remembered there was something else I was going to talk about. The team that I work in do not have homogenous kit. We're not all working on the same gear, even to the extent that the version of Ubuntu that I'm running is not the same as one of my colleagues who's on a previous LTS. One of my bosses on a Chromebook. You know, some of the people that we work with are on Macs and things like that. And one of the things that we've kind of suddenly realized is that actually it's really easy for somebody to write a script that works on their machine. And particularly I'm talking about command line tools. So I mentioned before about the MCP command line tool that I've written. And what I've started to do is actually, I took some inspiration from, there's a command that I found called bin, which has got, it's a dreadfully named application, but it's designed to, I don't know if you've seen, if you use something like Kubernetes, you're expected to download the Kubernetes binary from some GitHub repo somewhere. And if you want to use K9s, you have to download the K9s binary from somewhere and install that on your machine. And, you know, you can use tools like Homebrew, where that tends to be bundled up in things like that. But bin is really useful because all you do is you point at, so you say bin install github.com/K9s/K9s. For sake of argument, I don't know if that's the right URL. And that downloads, that says which, you know, it works out, oh, you're running Linux. So therefore, let's fuzzy match the name of the file in the releases directory for the word Linux. And you're on x86464-bit. So let's fuzzy match for that. Okay, here's three files that we think it might be. Which one of these is the one that you've got? You press a button and it downloads it. And then like Homebrew, you know, you could do Homebrew update or apt update or DNF update, whatever. It will say, oh, there's a new version out. You can download it. One of the URL types that bin supports is Docker. So if you've got a Docker container that runs one binary, you can do bin install docker:// whatever the path is to where the Docker image is. And so what I've started to do with the scripts that I'm writing is write them in such a way that they are expressed as a single binary that is then exposed in the Docker container. And this then means that you can write a small bash script to make sure you've got all the environment variables and that, all that sort of fun stuff to pass through to it. But then literally all your command is docker exec minus e environment variable equals value minus v for volume, and then path that you want it to mount for you, and then the command that you're going to run. So actually when you run the script that I'm writing at the moment, rather than targeting it at, oh, it's got to run on Ubuntu 24.04. It's a bit like a snap package from that perspective. You know, it's a containerized image that's got everything in it that you need. But again, because it's a Docker image, you can tag it and you can make sure that I want the version that was released on such and such a date, or, you know, I want the latest version. This command line tool that I've written to wrap the script does, you know, Docker pull before it runs it each time. So, you know, you've always got the latest version that's there, or you can tell it to run a specifically tagged version if you want to. But yeah, it's just a change in the way that I've started writing my scripts, just to make sure that everyone that I'm working with is all interacting with it in the same way. So you're not always reliant on, oh, this application needs Python 3.12.6 and such and such a libssl 1.1.1 or whatever. I'm trying to pick random things and going dreadfully here, but you know, you're not expecting people to have those dependencies. It just happens that everything's in the same, in the right place at the right time. So
I mean, that is kind of why Docker was invented, really, isn't it? So for, but more, you know, more for the app side of things, so that developers develop on their laptops, and it's the same thing that goes into production.
Yeah, but it's for me it's a another context shift. So I fully accept that is probably how it was designed, but people tend to write their Docker containers now to launch a web server or to run a long running process rather than to run a short lived thing that will only be there for this long to do that one thing.
Yeah, I mean, you quite often see that when how to install this CLI tool or whatever, and it has an example of a Docker, of how to do it with Docker. And I always think that's a bit of a faff, isn't it? You know, spinning up Docker to run it on your laptop. But yeah, it does make sense though.
So the reason that I first started, well, I say the reason, the first script that I wrote like this was one to, I've referred to it as hibernating, but to hibernate some of our auto-scaling groups in AWS. So I've got the command line tools, or the, you know, the Python and Boto 3 instructions to do that. And wrapping it in this just kind of means that no one needs to make sure they've got the right version of Boto 3. No one needs to make sure they've got the right version of whatever installed. As long as they've got AWS installed, the AWS command line tool, to get the STS, the short-lived token service tokens, they've got everything that they need to run the command. It's all there in one place. It just needs to go. And it means, because Macs have dodgy versions of Bash that don't always have all the right flags and switches and stuff set up, and they might not have the right version of grep or whatever. Whereas if you run Docker on Mac, you're guaranteed to have, you know, at least a version of Linux underneath it that should run the things that you need it to run. Or at least that's the plan anyway. We'll figure out what happens when my first colleague comes along that was running a Mac and says, oh, your script doesn't work, and then I have to figure out how to make it all work from there. But certainly that's a kind of, like I said, it's a template I'm going to start using going forward. So
yeah, sounds interesting. You talk about the token thing with AWS. What do you mean by that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to touch.
Because obviously I've come from Azure and then like from, say.
Sure. So in AWS, when you have an AWS account, whether that is authenticated using SAML or OIDC, or you are just using a static account that's been created for you. So, you know, you probably don't know, but if you go into AWS, into the IAM, which is the Identity and Access Management Service,
yeah,
and you create a user, you can create a set of access keys. So what you get with that is a client ID and a client secret.
Yep.
Now, whilst they are useful in their own right and can be used for a selected set of tools, tasks and activities, because they are long-lived tokens, you don't really want to be having those in shell scripts. You don't really want them being logged anywhere. So what AWS did quite early on, I don't know how long ago, but quite early on, they came up with this service called STS. And what you do with STS is you ask STS for a token. So when you construct your AWS command, what you typically do is you'll say AWS S3 LS, take your argument. And what happens is AWS takes the secret, the client and secret, combines it together and uses that as the way to sign the request that's been sent to the S3 service. And again, I am fudging this very heavily because I don't really know the internals. But instead, what you can do is you can take, when you do the STS get token, which again I'm hand waving because I can't remember exactly what the internals of it is, it returns a short lived token. And that, so whereas your IAM access key and token live until you rotate it, your STS token typically lasts at most an hour. And I think you can, in some cases, extend it to 4 hours, but it's like really short-lived. And if you use role assuming, so if you've got a SAML account or an OIDC account and you're authenticating into AWS with that, that is almost like another level of secret access abstraction. So you might have a 4 hour window on the SAML token, and then when you do STS, you get a 1 hour token. And we use that stuff all the time for where I am. But yeah, it's just a way of not even logging anywhere your long lived tokens and instead resorting to these short lived ones. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So with like Storage Accounts in Azure, you get the two keys, with access keys, which you can use to access it. But what you can do is you can generate SAS keys, which is basically say, I only want to be able to access this Storage Account using it for the next hour from this location.
Yeah, very similar. On that note, I think we've covered everything that we were going to talk about. It's been good fun, this. Thank you very much. Makes a difference not talking to myself.
Yeah, we'll wrap up because I know we've got battery problems. Jerry, can people get in contact with you if they're interested in your services?
Like I said, I've got a website in the works. So in a future podcast, we will have the URL in the show notes if anyone is interested. If not, there's always the Telegram group.
Well, talking of the Telegram group, if you're one of our listeners and you're not already in the Telegram group and you want to chat with us or with some of the other listeners, then you're welcome to join it. The details are on the website. And likewise, if you want to get in touch with us without joining the Telegram group, you can email. I always forget this. Is it show@ or mail at?
mail@admin-podcast.co.uk.
So you can tell it's been a while since I've done this. So you feel free to email us. We'd love to get your emails. We'd love to see if we can help you out. And as always, Dave Lee does the most amazing work with this audio. So thank you so much to Dave. We are a member of the Other Side Network, a podcast network for like-minded individuals like us. So feel free to find out more about them at otherside.network. OddCamp is coming up in April?
Yes.
April 24th, I believe.
Yeah. So we're all hoping to be there. Stu has said that he would like to meet us there, but we'll see what happens. He's got a lot of stuff going on in his life at the moment. Like I said, he might not be able to make it. But we'll hope to be there. I'm planning to do at least one talk. So yeah, it'll be good to see you there.
Cool. I've got a lift up there, but no accommodation yet. So maybe I'll be sleeping on the streets.
Oh God, don't say that. Sleep in the bar. No one will notice.
Okay then, we'll all see you soon. Bye for now.
See you then.
Bye.
Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I don't need you anymore. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over.
You've been listening to a member of the Otherside Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.